It's awfully dark in this tunnel, Latimer.
It's to add to the air of mystery, ma'am.
Where is it taking us exactly?
You'll see, ma'am. I promise you'll approve.
I've heard that before. This had better not end up with me in a black hole again, or being carried off by Viking warriors, or swallowed by a whale, or...
Here we are. I'll just open this secret door, like so. And done. After you, Mum.
Oh my God!
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't forgotten that we won a Hugo Award.
Mom!
Only joking, Latimer. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Well, I am so delighted to be able to welcome you into the White Drawing Room in Buckingham Palace. What a splendid place to enjoy a nice cup of tea. The chandeliers are very... very, and the sumptuous decor is quite extraordinary. There should be enough room for us all if we squeeze onto these beautiful cream sofas and Regency chairs, though we may not have enough footstools for everyone. No, that one's mine, darling. Just in case anyone is tempted, I think it would be best if we didn't play the gilded piano. Latimer, are you sure we're allowed to be in here? Is this something to do with the butler network you mentioned?
I've told you, ma'am. There is no butler network. There has never been a butler network.
Oh, right. This is like Fight Club, isn't it? The first rule of the butler network is that you never talk about the butler network.
What a ridiculous idea. How can one possibly belong to a club where the members aren't allowed to talk about it?
Is there a butler network or not?
If you'll excuse me, ma'am, there seems to be someone at the door.
That wasn't a denial. I think there is one, really. I bet they share secrets, tea-making tips, that sort of thing. I must find out more.
I'm sorry to disturb you, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Ken Liu.
Oh, splendid. Let's see his calling card. Ken Liu, writer, translator, programmer, lawyer. Oh, it's vanished.
I believe it's returned to Mr. Liu. He only has the one card.
Oh, how clever. What an excellent way to recycle and protect the trees.
Nonsense.
What's nonsense?
There's no way he could be accomplished in four careers at such a young age. He's either a vampire, a liar, or a genius. All to be avoided.
Oh, send him in, Latimer.
Very good, ma'am.
For those of you who don't know, Ken Liu writes silk punk epic fantasy and speculative fiction short stories. He has won the Hugo, Nebula and World Fantasy Awards, while somehow finding the time to be a translator, programmer and lawyer.
Mr. Ken Liu, ma'am.
Hello, Ken. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I am doing really well. Thank you, Emma.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased that I can offer you tea in Buckingham Palace.
This is the most amazing room, isn't it?
It really is. I can't stop looking at the chandeliers. They're just so sparkly. I'm such a magpie. I just can't stop looking at them.
You know, this is the sort of thing that my daughters would love if they were here. You know, we were on that cruise ship together for Writing Excuses. And do you remember there's that giant staircase that sparkled? That was blinding. I took my daughters there and they went up and down this staircase for, I think, half an hour at least, simply admiring it. I said that I was going to be blind after that.
It was quite extraordinary, wasn't it?
Not quite like this, though. This is also just amazing.
Yeah, I can't quite believe it. I keep thinking that somebody's going to burst in any moment and say, you can't be here, but I shouldn't tempt fate, should I?
No, let's not say that.
No. Would you care for some tea?
Yes, please. No milk.
No milk, just, and is English breakfast tea all right?
That is perfect.
Wonderful. I'll pour, And I was wondering if you would like some apple and blackberry crumble, seeing as it is autumn.
Oh, that would be delightful.
Marvellous. And would you like to have custard with it?
Yes, please.
Oh, I'm so pleased, because I can't trust anybody who doesn't want custard with their crumble. I get very suspicious.
You absolutely have to have custard. It's sort of like when you go to Starbucks and you order the pumpkin spice latte, you have to have whipped cream.
Well, yes, obviously. Now, don't mind the chickens over there in that little pen. They won't bother you. You're not allergic to chickens.
Not allergic to chickens. I'm a friend to birds of all kinds.
Marvellous. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
So I brought a little kite. The kite is made from old newspapers, and the skeleton is made from disposable chopsticks. This is a kite that I built with my daughters. It's something that I love sort of showing them how to do it, because, you know, so many times people just buy their kites. But I actually love making kites the way I used to do as a kid with my grandmother. Of course, these homemade kites never fly quite as well. But there's a joy to trying to adjust the strings and pieces of tape until you can actually get it to be balanced and take off in the air that I think you don't quite get with a bought kite.
Definitely. It's so lovely. It's just the kind of thing that you treasure forever.
It's certainly the memories are something that I hope that they will keep as they grow older. I have very fond memories of the kites that I built as a kid, even though so many of them ended up being power lines.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I still remember very, very, very clearly, going to fly a kite with my stepfather. It's such a simple thing, isn't it, as a child, but it is such a pure joy that you have when the kite is up in the air and you can feel it tugging on the string and that you have control of it. It's, I don't know, there is something genuinely magical about it.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, my obsession with kites is longstanding. I mean, like you were saying, there's certain magic to the idea that you can take paper and string and bits of bamboo and make something that will actually fly, and you actually understand why it's flying. It's sort of the same motivation behind, you know, how I ended up writing these giant epic fantasy novels in which the magic really isn't magic, but just building things, engineering, if you will.
Mm. Now, this may be an odd question, but Latimer and I had a very little debate before you arrived, and I just wanted to double check. You're not a vampire, are you?
As far as I know, no. Now, how did this come up as a topic?
Well, he was really quite impressed by the number of careers that you're expert in. And he said that you had to be either a liar, which is obviously not even on the table, or a vampire, or a genius. So seeing as we've eliminated 2 out of 3, then I'm afraid you're just going to have to settle for genius. You don't mind, do you?
I really like the process of elimination. That's the sort of logic that we need to apply more often. I like the way you think, Emma.
I'm actually really quite fascinated by the number of languages that you're expert in, and not just the obvious Chinese and English that we see in your writing and translation career, but also the language of the law and the language you use to program computers. And what I'd like to know is if they exist as completely separate entities in your mind, or is there kind of a cross-pollination between them all?
I say there's quite a bit of cross-pollination. I mean, you know, what's sort of funny about it is I have had multiple careers, but they're all sort of related in that they all involve building things out of symbols. You know, when I was a programmer, what I did was building symbols of the programming language to create a program, which, subject to the rules of the programming language, achieved a certain result for the client or just whatever I wanted to do. It's building a symbol machine. When I was a lawyer, it's really the same thing. I specialized in taxation law, and so that really meant that I was often charged with constructing contracts and structures of business entities in such a way that they would allow the revenues to flow around in a manner that to the taxation authorities would achieve the best result for the client. And so in that case, I was building another machine, the legal entities that achieved a certain result. And amusingly, in both programming and in law, you often have the same solution to problems. There's an old adage in programming which says that any problem is solved by an extra level of indirection. What that means is to add another level of abstraction so that you can deal with the problem by uncouple things that are unnecessarily coupled together. And in the law, it's the same thing. Any problem can be solved by adding an extra level of indirection, an extra level of entity for flowing the money around. This is why you have such arcane structures in international business organizations, because they want things to flow in such a way that where you make the profit isn't where you're taxed. So anyway, what I've ended up settling on as a writer, it's still the same thing. What I do is I create stories, which are really symbol structures of words and tropes and metaphors and themes that are supposed to achieve a certain emotional result in the reader. But fundamentally, it's the same thing. We're building machines out of symbols that do a certain thing that feels wondrous, much as what you feel when you fly a kite.
You know, there is something so comforting about the way you describe that to me. But one of the things that I find really fascinating, because I've done a little bit of programming in my time, not for a few years, it'd be horribly out of date now, but I used to do PHP and MySQL and, you know, HTML years ago this was. And the thing that I loved about coding was that if you got it right, it worked. And if it didn't work, you knew that you had made an error somewhere and you could go back and check it until you found the error and then it would work. And it was just beautiful in that way. But with writing, it's such a subjective thing. So how do you accommodate the kind of the artistic aspect, the subjective aspect in this kind of machine that you're building?
You're absolutely right about that. As you well know, it's not so much that programming is completely devoid of the aesthetic aspects, because, you know, people debate all the time over what solution is more elegant, one versus another. So there is, you know, definitely a large part of aesthetics in programming, but you're right. Fundamentally, there is a distinction in that when you're programming, there's a very simple way to tell if the thing works or not, which is, does it work or not?
Yeah.
in writing, there just really isn't.
If only there was.
I know, if only there were. I'm not sure I have a good solution for it. It's a thing that troubles me all the time, too. I try something, and I think it's the most amazing, creative, original thing I've done. And then, you know, I get it out there, and people react with, you know, meh. And then you're sort of crushed when that happens. But, you know, I don't have a good answer for you. I'm not sure I've ever really reconciled myself to it. The closest I've come to is the sense that, you know, we're all in some ways locked into our own heads. We can empathize with others, but we can never really truly think as another human being. And so the best we can do is to try to write something that is really pleasing and beautiful and amazing to us, and then just hope that we're not such oddballs that other people react the same way. Because beyond that, we really don't have a lot. We don't have a universal Turing machine of emotional processing that we can resort to test, you know, if what we've done actually works for everyone. We only have ourselves. And therein lies both the tragedy and also the beauty of writing, I suppose. It's an intensely subjective effort whose true purpose really is to connect with other people.
Definitely. When I think about languages, I used to speak French and Spanish fluently. This was 20 odd years ago, and it's horrifically rusty now. But one of the things that I adored about learning languages were the little quirky differences between them that really, really delighted me on a deep level. And one of the ones that I happened across in Spanish is that in Spanish you say "it pleases me" instead of "I like something."
Right, right.
And It fascinates me, just that really subtle difference, which is such a small thing on the surface, but to me speaks volumes. I was wondering if you could describe a really interesting kind of difference or quirk when translating between Chinese and English.
Oh, sure. You know, there's actually quite a lot of it. Usually the way I sort of approach the problem is, you know, it's very common. You see all sorts of articles on the web talking about how, you know, oh, you know, we wish English had a word like this that they have in German. Or, you know, there's this amazing Japanese word that we don't have that word in English for. I think that's all very cool and interesting, but that's not the sort of thing that gets me all misty-eyed and philosophical. I'm much more interested by the ways in which languages require certain things to be encoded versus things that are optional. And different languages really require different things to be specified. I mean, you know, for example, in Chinese, marking something as plural is optional. You can certainly mark a thing as plural when you're talking about multiple instances of it. But you can also just not do that and let it be a thing that's unspecified. In English, we don't really have that construction. We sort of have to specify something singular or plural. So there are always instances where, you know, it's in Chinese, it's like, is there just one person in the room or multiple people in the room? And in Chinese, it's not specified, but in English, you can't leave it unspecified. And so I have to sort of sometimes contact the author and sort of pin that down. And it's sort of fascinating how often that comes up. Another, you know, example would be in Chinese, you don't have the grammatical tenses that we do in English. So something can, there obviously, you know, are ways to mark other aspects of verbal conjugation, but tenses as we have them don't exist in Chinese. And so it is possible to tell a story in a way that when you're trying to translate into English, you have to decide, am I going to do this in the past or in the present tense? Both are possible, but they would sound entirely different. It's one of the bigger decisions I have to make as a translator when I'm reading a story and deciding what to do. Do I, you know, try to translate the story using the past tense or the present? And they feel very, very different. But in Chinese, that's not an issue. It's not specified. So, you know, I always find that sort of thing really interesting. But also, at the same time, there are, because some of my stories written in English are translated to Chinese, the kind of questions that I get from Chinese translators are, you know, also fascinating in the other direction, because there are things that we left unspecified, we leave unspecified in English that cannot be unspecified in Chinese. I mean, for instance, you know, if I say grandmother or sister, that's that. But in Chinese, you can't actually say that. You have to specify if you're talking about a maternal grandmother or a paternal grandmother.
Oh, wow, that's so fascinating.
These are entirely different words, and you have to specify older sister or younger sister, entirely different words. So, you know, it's really interesting. And the other aspect that I think tends to be come up a lot in translation is that Chinese, similar to Japanese, has an entire set of honorifics, nicknames, endearments, diminutives, and other ways to address someone. You don't address someone just by their name. That almost never happens, except if you really don't know them at all, or if you are trying to, you know, suggest that there's a lot of distance between you. But if you know someone or you're trying to indicate your relationship, you always address someone using a title or a term of endearment or a nickname or diminutive of some sort or a title of some sort. So how you address someone is very complicated, and it's very revealing about how close you feel to that person and how you feel the difference in your social hierarchy and ranks are. But in English, we tend to not have that, especially among Americans. You know, this tendency to address everyone by their first names, given names, is sort of a universal approach. And so a lot of times in the Chinese novel, the way people are addressing each other contains a lot of information, which when you're translating to English would have to be specified in some other way, or indicate using a different strategy. So that always poses an interesting challenge.
Oh, that I love all this. I'm really nerding out about all this kind of stuff.
It's really cool to sort of see, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, I've also had interesting issues where, you know, I wrote some story in English where it was intentional that the gender of the protagonist was never specified. And this drives some of my translators nuts into the Romance languages because they tell me you can't do that. You know, there are things I have to sort of decide how to say. And you have to tell me, you know.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me that how some languages allow you to leave certain things unspecified and other languages just won't.
I have to ask you this because I know that I'm just going to be lying awake at 3 o'clock in the morning going, but why? If I don't ask you. But the whole thing about not needing to specify like the number of people in the room in your example.
Yeah.
Does that usually get covered in context in if you're speaking in Chinese?
It does. Yes. Here's something that's fascinating. I mean, languages evolved not via text, but via, you know, people speaking to each other. So a lot of times people, when they hear, you know, how Chinese doesn't have tenses or the, you know, number is optional, they're like, how can you possibly speak like that? How do you ever, you know, get any idea across? Well, the thing is, in actual speech, a lot of this stuff, like you point out, is clear from context, from the topic of conversation. And where ambiguity would be problematic, Chinese obviously has tons of ways for you to actually resolve the ambiguity. It's just that in a lot of instances where the ambiguity does not need to be resolved, Chinese allows you to leave it to be unresolved. And as a translator, you can't. So that's where the clash happens.
I find that really interesting because we studied L'Étranger by Camus in French. And there was a lot of discussion about the fact that L'Étranger, the actual word, can mean so many different things, but that in English, we would define it as a much more granular kind of definition. We would say the stranger, or we would say the outsider, or we would say the foreigner. And yet in the story, it looks at all of these things, and it's important that it's not necessarily specified at various points, which I adored. And you have that a lot in French, that it just has fewer words, and so you have more freedom in a way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a similar issue with Chinese too. I found that oftentimes dictionaries are incredibly misleading because, you know, dictionaries define words between languages and they have to use words. But really the semantic mapping of words that are described as definitions for each other in a dictionary don't actually overlap exactly. And it is generally the case that English has a much larger vocabulary compared to many other languages. And so concepts that in other languages are encompassed under one word are often specified, subdivided into multiple words in English. And so when you're translating into English all the time, I have to struggle with what specific word is actually meant. Whereas in the original Chinese, for example, sometimes the multitude of meanings is included within that one word. And then I have to decide which particular English word describes the aspect that matters, you know, the most in that context. And it's not always easy. And sometimes it's not obvious at all. And so I've had this discussion with a lot of my Chinese friends, and they say that, you know, one of the sort of feelings they take away from one of my translation is they often feel like I've specified certain things in their story that they had originally left undefined. Not because they hadn't thought of it, but they sort of wanted that ambivalence. And so we often have to sort of have a debate over exactly how to do this. Sometimes it's not possible to leave things undefined when you do an English translation. I know some translators use the strategy of just using multiple words, whereas the original had just one word. You would just, you know, use all the words that are possible to try to capture that nuance. But then you end up with a pleonastic translation that reads extremely awkward. And, you know, for something like the Bible, I think sometimes that works. And I know that some Bible translators actually do take that approach. But it doesn't really work for contemporary fiction. And so there's always that slippage between the need in English to specify versus the tendency in Chinese to leave a lot of these emotional or descriptive terms in this state of quantum indeterminacy.
Ah, it's so fascinating. There is a genuine art to translation. That do you feel that there is kind of a more demanding art when you're translating between Chinese and English than, say, if you were translating between, I don't know, French and English or French and Spanish? Do you think that some languages are more distant and in that distance there's the art?
I wouldn't say languages are distant. I would say cultures are more distant. I mean, I think, you know, linguistically, the complexities of trying to render linguistic differences and to cross that bridge between different languages is almost always super difficult. I mean, even going from Cantonese to Mandarin, which are very closely related languages, can be very complicated and difficult due to grammatical differences and the way certain words and phrases have been preserved from the root language in one modern language, but not in the other. What is far more difficult are cultural differences. This is why, even though, you know, Cantonese and Mandarin are very different languages, because they're culturally very close, trying to go between them is not nearly as difficult in my mind as trying to go from, say, Russian to English or from German to English, which are, you know, also linguistically closely related, but culturally have been very different for a long time. In the case of Chinese and English, that certainly is the case. The cultural differences are immense. And a lot of the complexities and difficulties I have to deal with, you know, have to do with cultural issues. So this is also made more complicated by the fact that because languages represent cultures, and cultures are not all equal in power, going in certain directions is easier versus than others. So let me give you an example. You know, this is an example that a lot of, I think, American or Anglophone readers will grasp. Because Greek or classical Greek is considered a very prestigious language, it represents a very prestigious culture. Greek names are never translated into English, even though they all mean something in the original Greek. So we just know Greek names by learning the names. We don't actually translate them. Native American names, on the other hand, when rendered into English, there's always a tendency for people to translate them into English phrases. Because I think when the culture is not considered prestigious or have great power, translating their names is a way for us to sort of gain power over them.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's why Native American names are almost always translated rather than left in the original language. And you can sort of see this happen to Japanese, too. In the early days of Japanese to English translation, because Japanese culture was not seen as a great prestigious culture, Japanese names were often, in fact, translated. And that almost never happens now. And you can sort of see that evolving over time. In fact, you know, in the case of my translation from the Three Body Problem to English, I actually had to deal with this. One of the beta readers told me that, you know, they found the Chinese names really, really hard to keep straight in their heads. And why don't I just translate them so that, you know, people be named Summer or something or Spring Poplar or something? And I said, I'm not going to do that. That's just that's an approach that just feels really, really colonialist, and it just will not work. But there's definitely that aspect of it, you know, the idea of languages and culture and prestige and power. These are all interconnected, you know. And then another example may be somewhat easier to sort of get across. When a Chinese writer is writing a story, they often feel very free to make references to Western culture. So they will cite to Greek myth. They will, you know, bring up Persephone and Hades. They're willing to reference American pop culture. And so they'll talk about Friends and about Seinfeld. They'll quote from Anna Karenina or, you know, some amazing, some classical French novel. They're willing to do all that. And the assumption is simply that the Chinese reader, an educated Chinese reader, will know what these things are. So when you're translating from English into Chinese, you can leave these references as they are without much trouble. But when you're going from Chinese to English, it's quite different. If a Chinese writer makes references to classical Chinese historical events or allusions to Chinese classics, they won't make much sense to the average Anglophone reader, simply because we don't really know much about Chinese history or, you know, the Chinese classics. So you're left with the decision of what to do. You can either try to leave these references as they are and then just either add a footnote to explain or note footnote and hope that the reader will look it up somehow or just be confused. Or you can try to, quote unquote, translate the reference into something that feels equivalent for a Western reader. So, you know, for example, if you're trying to describe a man as being very handsome in Chinese, you would often use the phrase Mao Ruo Pan An, which means he's as handsome as Pan An. Pan An is a historical figure, a man known for his great beauty. He used to sort of parade down the street in a cart, and women would stop by to stare at him and throw him flowers and fruits and vegetables and sort of express how much they liked looking at him. He's sort of the Edward Cullen of his day, if you will. And if you were to translate that into English, you know, you could sort of leave that reference, or you can sort of do the thing a lot of translators do, which is to say, you know, he was like an Adonis, you know, which would be a kind of equivalent. But it's not exactly the same. There are always slippages in that sort of thing. And sometimes those kind of erudite translation of references can end up sounding extremely awkward and misleading, mainly because, you know, a lot of contemporary Chinese works make use of Western references in the first place. And so now you're sort of flattening everything into this Western reference framework, and it sort of loses the impact of the original. So it's a tricky problem, but, you know, always sort of fun to deal with. So I think going from Chinese into English is particularly difficult, mainly because the cultural gap is large. Lots of things that are very common in Chinese culture have no real Western equivalent. And so, you know, that requires some struggle. Ironically, the sort of Chinese texts that I found easiest to translate to English are tend to be technical documents or academic documents, for the simple reason that that kind of awkward academic writing, which, you know, where academics try to sound smart but are not in fact saying anything intelligent, where they use long words and long, complicated sentence structures, that kind of structure appears to be universal, at least based on the Chinese papers I've read. I'm quite convinced that many of these scholars, because they read the same papers, end up replicating the very same structure in their own writing. And so you have this sort of translation knees going on, where the Chinese sounds as though it were translated from English in the first place. And so translating to English is a breeze.
I so remember that kind of first, I don't know, I suppose for probably a month when I very first started university and I had to read scientific papers, and it was like, whoa, I have to read this three times. And then you kind of get into the rhythm of that form of writing. And I haven't thought about that for years, actually. It's a very distinct form, isn't it?
It is. It depends on the subject, too. I'm mainly thinking of a lot of social science papers I've read in English.
Yeah, psychology.
They have a certain distinct approach, and literary criticism, of course, you know, is its own thing, where people are always saying things, and you're like, okay, that was a lot of words, and what did you actually mean?
Yeah, let's boil this down, shall we? Yeah, definitely. Well, I could talk to you about language for about a week if I had, you know, enough to eat and drink. I have to rein myself in. You mentioned the writing excuses cruise that we enjoyed earlier this year, and I still actually can't believe that happened.
Me neither. It was so amazing.
It was amazing, wasn't it? I was thinking about that ship and that kind of really bizarre kind of bubble that it kind of surrounds you with when you're on a cruise, and how the experience that you have on there is really dictated by the ship itself. I was wondering if you had the power to change one feature, what would you add to the cruise ship? And is there something that you would take away?
Wow, that is a complicated question. My gosh, You know, I'm not sure. I mean, it was just such a large ship to take in. It was such an incredible experience. I'm still coming to terms with it. You know, I'm sort of like my daughters in that way, where I'm thinking back to the ship, but I'm sort of like, I still can't quite believe that was a real thing.
Yeah.
Let me see. If I had to take one thing away, okay, I'll tell you one thing I would add first. I would definitely try to add better signage throughout the ship.
Yes.
It was very hard, even after, you know, a week on the ship, for me to figure out where I am and where I need to go. Those little maps helped, but they needed more of those, and they needed better signage in general to direct me to go where I wanted to go. I think that would be one thing I would add. In terms of something to take away, you know, they had those lifeboats on the, was it the seventh deck or whatever it was, where they blocked the view outside the windows. I just wonder if they can move those lifeboats somewhere so that they don't block the view, because, you know, those were incredible rooms. But, and, you know, it would be lovely to actually look out and see the ocean and the sunset and whatever city we happen to be at, instead of just having the entire view blocked by the lifeboats. That would be one thing I would take away. But keep the lifeboats. I'm not saying get rid of the lifeboats. I just want to be clear. Yes, lifeboats are awesome, but they need to be moved somewhere.
It's just, well, I'm really fascinated by it being like the ultimate closed environment. Like, as science fiction writers, you know, we imagine spaceships. And I had this thought when I was on the cruise, like, this might be the closest, bizarrely, the closest experience I would have to being like on a spaceship or a generation ship or something like that, where there's the attempt to create an environment which gives you everything you could possibly want quite quickly and keeps you safe, and yet is also entertaining. And it's just such a weird experience.
That really is. I mean, you know, that reminds me of WALL-E, the film, you know, in which the human spaceships really were modeled on cruise ships, right? That's what they were. So that is actually a very good analogy. So we were on a spaceship.
It certainly felt like we were on another planet a lot of the time when I was on that ship. Yeah, very much so. A very, very serious question now. If you could invent a cocktail which had a magical effect, what would the effect be, and what would you call your cocktail?
Oh my gosh, what a question. Well, this is actually not very difficult for me. This will be a cocktail that you serve before you do a reading to the audience, right? And the effect would be, the audience would think that everything you're saying from that point on is the most brilliant thing they have ever heard.
Yes.
That would be, and the cocktail would be, what would I name it? I'm going to be boring and just call it the bestseller. That's what I'm going to call it.
Oh, yes. I really want someone to invent that. Can it be one of those cocktails as well that doesn't, you can't taste the alcohol?
Yeah. So, that would be perfect. Yes, exactly. Right? I mean, you should serve that before every reading. You know, people imbibe it and they're just like, wow, I'm so glad I came. She's brilliant.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Yes. Yeah, so, someone please invent that. Oh, no. I'm only here temporarily. I'm not actually queen. Damn. Oh, well, never mind. So when I invite a friend to tea, I ask on the Twitters if there is a question that anyone would like me to ask on their behalf, because they couldn't make it to Buckingham Palace today. And Lissa Cooley asked, when you start feeling discouraged, what helps you muster up your forces to keep going? I think, you know, as writers, we all know that feeling where we get discouraged.
Absolutely. Okay, so I will tell a story that will provide the answer. I actually stopped writing for a period of 6 years or so, when I just didn't write at all. And it largely happened because of one story. I wrote this one story called Single Bit Error, which I thought was the greatest thing I've ever written. And I submitted everywhere for publication, and nobody bought it. I mean, I tried every market. You know, I went from the top pro paying markets all the way to the semi-pros and then down to the tokens. And nobody wanted it. I believe that story ended up, you know, accumulating at least of all the rejections I've saved, 20 plus rejections from pro or semi-pro venues. And this was, you know, back in early 2000s. So there weren't nearly as many active markets as there are now. And so I became obsessed. And since I couldn't get the story published, I decided that I was no good at it. And I decided I had to give up on this whole writing thing. And so I stopped writing for, you know, as I mentioned, 6 or 7 years until, you know, an anthology came along that the call for submissions specified that they wanted stories that had been rejected multiple times before. So I submitted my story, and of course they bought it. And you know, it felt like the universe was, you know, trying to tell me a message after this. So that's how I got started writing again. But here's the thing. This is the lesson that I think I should have taken away from the story. The lesson isn't that, you know, sometimes you get lucky and the universe sends you a message. I mean, maybe that's what happens, but that's not something you should count out. The thing that the lesson to actually take away from this is this. You can't confuse goals with milestones. Mm. Milestones are nice things that you like to happen to you. I didn't come up with this distinction. Tobias Bacow actually is the one who came up with it. And I really think that it works well. Goals are things you can control. Milestones are things, nice things you like to happen to you, but are not within your control. So milestones are things like getting published in a pro magazine, selling your novel to a great big house publisher, becoming a bestseller, having everyone at the reading exclaim over how brilliant you are, showing up on TN Jeopardy. You know, these are milestones, nice things that happen to you, but they're not things within your control. Goals, on the other hand, are things you can actually control. You know, they're things like, I'm going to finish this story. I'm going to start another story. I'm going to finish that story too. I'm going to read a book. I'm going to read 5 books in the genre I'm interested in this year. I'm going to actually finish this novel I've been telling myself I want to write. These are things that are within your control that are actually things you can take active steps towards accomplishing, and you know you can actually get closer to it each time you pound out a word. If you focus on goals and actually just stick to those, then despair and discouragement are not things that will bother you because you have accomplished your goals. The reason why I felt so disappointed and actually, you know, was in such despair that I gave up was because I was confusing milestones with goals. I had no control over whether the editors would connect with my story. You know, as I mentioned earlier, when we first started talking, writing is the both the beauty and the terror of writing is that it's an intensely subjective thing where you have to create something that is beautiful to you, but you have no way to judge whether something is beautiful except your own taste. And you can't chase trends or try to replicate the magic of someone else or try to do what they do. You just can't. You only know your own mind. You only know your own taste. You only know what is beautiful and pleasing to you. So all you can do is to keep on doing that, writing things that you believe are beautiful, and then leave, you know, milestones to others. You have no control over it, and you can't despair over not getting a milestone, and you can't celebrate as though it's all about your own effort when you achieve one, because neither is true. The only thing that is true is actual goals that you set for yourself that you can actually meet. And as long as you keep your eyes on goals rather than milestones, I think you're much more likely to be happy with yourself and to actually enjoy what you're doing.
I think that is just some of the best advice I've heard in a long time. I think it's so easy to conflate the two. And it's so easy, especially when you are in the early stages of, you know, like the first year to 5 years of your writing career, and you have like a cohort of other authors that were debuts at the same time as you. And there's this kind of really irritating natural human urge to compare yourself with where your peers are and seeing them go off and, you know, do amazing things. And it's the most toxic thing you can do to yourself.
It really is.
Yeah. And focusing on your own goals is like the best antidote to that, because it's like they say in that song, isn't it? The race is long and it's only with yourself.
So. Yes, you're 100% right. I mean, you know, my mistake was not writing another story. I mean, the right response to rejections is to just write another story. And I didn't do that. I became obsessed with something over which I had no control. And as you mentioned, one of the most toxic things that can happen to creative people is letting jealousy dictate how they ought to feel. You know, as you mentioned, you know, precisely because this is a business in which the subjective, the unquantifiable is so dominant, there's a tendency to not only compare yourself to others, but to start to attribute other people's success to factors that are really not really related. You know, it's because, you know, there's this human tendency to compare yourself to your cohorts, and when they achieve success, you start to feel like somehow that they don't deserve it, that you ought to deserve it. You know, you work just as hard. You know, why isn't your book, you know, being reviewed by the New York Times? You know, you work just as hard, and then you went to all those conventions. Why aren't people, you know, talking about you? You start to have these really, really toxic feelings, not just about your own work, but about other people. And it becomes this terrible monster of jealousy that I think we all feel the threat of, and we don't want to talk about it. But I think it's real. And I think the solution for that, you know, not only is to focus on your own goals, but also to try to be generous and try to contribute to the community. I think one of the best antidotes to the threat of jealousy taking over yourself is to actually try to help and to make the community and the world better. You know, instead of feeling like, why is it that, you know, these people who started at the same time as me, they're getting these bestsellers now, they're getting all these great reviews. Instead of like feeling angry about that, go and write positive reviews about books you love. You know, try to introduce authors that you think deserve more recognition to readers. Try to connect more editors with authors when they have an anthology and they want to have a good, diverse invitation list. You know, suggest people. Mm-hmm. Try to, if you get on some panels and you feel like another writer can use the slot and to promote their work, then, you know, suggest them as an alternative to yourself. There are all kinds of things you can do to help and to make the place better. Because, you know, here's the other thing about the creative field. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not like, you know, people buy your friend's book or your rival's book, and they're not going to buy your book. That may happen once in a blue moon, but that's not how it really works. When there are wonderful books in a genre, readers get excited and they want to read more. Yes, so, definitely. You know, if you're promoting other people's work, that can only create more readers and get people more excited. And that helps everyone. That helps the entire field. We're not competing, you know, against each other, really, even though it seems that way. We're actually competing against, you know, video games and clickbait articles and Twitter arguments. We're trying to compete for people's time against those things. And I think if there's a way for us to promote other people's work and to make the world a more friendly place, a more thoughtful place for art, for reading, for books, then we should do that. And the thing is, you know, once we do it, I really think we stop feeling the pangs of jealousy, because the best antidote is to have a generous spirit. And you can't have a generous spirit unless you actually go and do generous things.
Definitely. The other thing that I think is some of the best advice I heard was something you said on the cruise, actually, when we were hanging out in the bar. And you said, you know, if you're not scared when you're starting to write your next book, then there's something wrong. You're not stretching yourself. So it's good to feel scared.
Yeah.
So, this last 2 weeks where I've been starting a new book and like, oh no, I really don't think I could do it. No, it's okay. Ken said this is good. This is fine. We're going to sit down. We're going to write the thing that's scary. So
I know, thank you for that. I know you're going to do it. No, it's true. I really think so. You know, I'm terrified right now because I'm dealing with, every book you work on, doesn't that feel like the hardest book ever, you know?
And the first book you've ever written as well. It's like you forget, even if you've written like 10 other books, it's like, no, I have no idea how I did that. Someone else wrote those, obviously, because I can't remember how to do that. Did I do that? How did I do that?
Yep. And then I think we have to embrace it. You know, that's kind of the joy of this job. It's the terror and the joy of it.
Yeah, it doesn't, it's not boring, is it?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, I mean, creating your own monsters and fighting them, you're gazing into the abyss every day. You know, what could be better?
Yeah, no wonder I drink so much tea. It's that old whiskey, and you know, I write better with tea.
Yeah, tea is definitely the healthier choice.
Yes, definitely. So the chickens over there are quite amazing, actually, quite extraordinary chickens. And what I like to do is when my friends come for tea, I like to ask them what would be the theme tune of their life, just purely so that I can show off these amazing chickens. So, Ken, what would be the theme tune of your life so I can ask the chickens over there to sing it for
you? Oh, that's easy. That would be the main theme to Pacific Rim.
Oh, wow. Very dramatic. Is this you heroically striding towards doing battle with your next book and all of the fears associated with it?
It's something like that. I mean, what it really is, you know, when I was writing my first novel, I kept on listening to it over and over again every time I was writing a battle scene. I think it really helped me get into the mood for it. And also, I mean, every time I hear it, I think of these giant robots who have rockets in their elbows so they can punch harder. I mean, how cool is that? How can you not be simply delighted by a universe in which that is the way things are?
Absolutely. What's not to love? So, little chickens, please could you sing the main theme of the Pacific Rim soundtrack for Ken, please? And there they go.
I don't know what to say. This may be the most heroic chicken tune I have ever heard. I had no idea chickens are capable of such heroism.
Have you noticed that they're kind of strutting with their little chest feathers further out? They're taking on the spirit of it.
I see that. Yes, this is clearly necessary for everybody. I mean, look at these chickens. They can take on anything.
Better make sure the corgis are safe, because I reckon they'd go and have a go right now. Right. So settle down, little chickens. It's okay. There are no monsters. Right. There we go. They've settled down. Well, I've never seen them do that before. That's very cool. I understand that you have a Star Wars book coming out. Is that true?
I do. It's coming out on Halloween, October 31st, called The Legends of Luke Skywalker.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I can't tell you how excited I am that I got to do this. You know, I've been a lifelong Star Wars fan. And in fact, I have this vivid experience of I was in college, and this was the day before the finals, and I can't remember the final for what class, but I know that I had to cram for it because I wasn't ready. But, you know, I was like, well, you know, cramming session is really painful. I need something to sort of, I need a treat to reward myself. And so I went down to the bookstore and got the latest Star Wars trilogy. Can't remember which one it was, but I brought it back and I said, you know, I'll just read a couple pages to get myself in the mood for studying. And then, of course, you know, I couldn't really stop. And so I read the first book, and then I was like, well, you know, I already read one and it's still only 11 at night. I'm sure there's plenty of time, you know, let me just read another book. And so before I knew it, you know, it was like, I think 7 in the morning. And I had not gone to bed. I had not done any studying whatsoever, and the exam was in an hour and a half. I had to rush down to breakfast, and my mind was just blank. I don't remember anything about the thing that I was supposed to actually be prepared to answer questions on. I just remember Star Wars. And all the way through the quad, I was like, okay, this is probably one of the stupidest decisions I've ever made. But that's okay. You know, it's worth it. That was a cool book. It was really awesome. And I did pass the exam. I graduated, not fail. So that was good.
That's good.
Yeah. So I have this, you know, deep connection to Star Wars, and it was, it's very important to me. And so when I got invited to write a Star Wars book, I was just absolutely ecstatic. It was the most awesome thing ever.
I mean, it really is like the cultural cornerstone of space opera. It is the thing, isn't it, that we've all grown up with. What an amazing feeling it must be to be part of that.
Yeah, you know, Star Wars is like Harry Potter. It's part of the mythology that we now speak to each other in.
Yes.
Except, you know, in Star Wars, you know, you can actually add to it when you're invited to do so. And that is super cool.
So the Legends of Luke Skywalker, are these individual stories? Is it a novel? Can you tell us anything more?
Yeah, I can. So as you well know, we don't quite know what happened to Luke after Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. We got a nice little hint of it when we see him years later. So the question is, you know, what happened to Luke Skywalker? Well, you know, the premise of my book is that Luke is a figure of legend, not just to us, but also in his universe. This is a hero of the Republic, you know, legendary Jedi Knight, last of the Jedi Knight. And so there must be tons of stories about him being passed from cantina to from depot to depot, from smuggler ship to smuggler ship. Mm-hmm. And so the premise of the book is there's a crew on a long range deep space freighter, and they're going on this journey, and the deckhands are bored, and they start telling each other Luke Skywalker stories. And these are stories that they've heard, and they're from all sorts of different perspectives. There are some stories about Luke being told from the perspective of Imperial sympathizers. There are stories being told by real Luke as a hero worshippers. There are stories being told by droids. There are stories being told by aliens, non-human species. And everybody has a different view of Luke. And who knows which of these stories are true and which ones are not true and which ones are, you know, spiced up and which ones are based on facts but have been drastically altered by perspective. So it's a lot of fun. And one of the best things about it is, you know, because of the nature of the book, I can have a kind of relationship with the canon that I've always enjoyed, which is, you know, this quantum indeterminacy. You know, is this bit I'm telling here actually canon or not? Because of the nature of the book itself, that's not necessarily something that's easy to determine. And I like that.
I love that too. And I love that there is it's almost like a realism, isn't it? That you're recreating something that we have in the real world, the way that people talk about legendary figures.
That's right. I mean, think about it, like the way we talk about somebody like, say, George Washington, right? There's always that story about the cherry tree. Is that story really real? You know, who knows? Right.
I was thinking about all the stories about Prince that you hear.
Yes.
And you know, all the crazy things he did, and you hear it and you go, did he really do that? And you're like, well, you know, he could have. That just sounds like the kind of thing he would do.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. That's great. Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
I had so much fun writing it, so I'm looking forward to sharing it with everybody.
Now let me just check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty, and we're probably getting to the point where it's a little bit risky staying here this long, to be honest. No one's come. I think maybe it's a message from the universe, like it was with that anthology. you know, that we were supposed to be here having tea together in this room today. Obviously, this was meant to be. So I'm so glad.
Thank you.
We've probably run out of luck. So I'm going to say thank you so much for coming to take tea with me today. It is always a joy being able to sit down and chat with you about geeky linguistic stuff and writing stuff. And I'm so pleased that we got to spend time together on the cruise. It was just the most magical time. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Emma. It's such a pleasure.
I hope that our strange adventures in the life of authoring will mean that we can do it again in person sometime soon.
Absolutely.
So take care. And if you follow Latimer, he will show you the secret route out so that we won't be discovered, hopefully.
Oh, excellent.
And we'll make sure that you can get home safely. So take care, and I'll hopefully see you soon.
All right. Thank you. You take care too.
Bye.
Bye.
This way, sir. Quickly, ma'am. Into the passage. There's a footman coming.
But I thought we were allowed to be here, you know, because of the butler network.
The footman network hates the butler network.
So there is one. I knew it.
Bother.
Oh, no. The footman looks awfully stern. Oh, he's intercepted Ken.
Intruder, if you wish to leave this palace with your life, you must answer my riddle.
Well, that's unexpected.
Oh, these footmen, always going on with their ridiculous riddles. The sun shines extra bright for me, but I am not dazzled by its light. My stories are dark, shifting their form to best horrify people of many nations. It will always look better on me. Who am I?
The answer to your riddle is a mirror. The sun shines extra bright in any room in which a looking glass is placed, but the glass itself is not dazzled by the fiery orb. Yet, a mirror offers no light of its own and is a dark abyss into which everyone gazes and sees reflected back their innermost fears. The monster we see when each of us gazes into the mirror is different and of endless variety, for there is no end to the variation of human depravity. But whatever monsters haunt our darkest tales and nightmares, we can find them in the mirror. For there is no monster. The monster is us. And finally, however much vanity one possesses, a jewel always looks better when doubled by the mirror. So of course it looks better on him. It should be the aim of every author to be the truest of mirrors and the darkest of soul reflectors. Now out of my way, witless fool, for there are wonders to be celebrated and horrors to be confronted.
Mom, are you swooning?
No, I'm not. I'm just stressed. Now hand me my fan. Oh my God, the Duchess of Cornwall has arrived. This is getting worse.
Mr. Lou doesn't seem concerned, and neither is she. She seems very happy to lend him the mirror she's carrying.
He's turning it on the footman.
Footman, ridiculous creatures.
He's impressed the Duchess of Cornwall. I think she's inviting him to lunch.
Or his execution.
Lunch, Latimer. Look, she's smiling.
My point exactly, ma'am.
While Latimer clears away any evidence of our being here, I'd just like to raise my teacup to David Mackey, Matt Williams, and Igor Rendich, the newest members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy. Before Latimer gets back, I'd also like to let you know that my next novella in the Industrial Magic series, Weaver's Lament, has just been released and is on sale now. It's set in 1850s England, where advances in magic, rather than science, have brought about the Industrial Revolution.
What was that about revolution, ma'am? It's hardly the safest topic in Buckingham Palace.
Nothing. Find us a new tea there, would you, Latimer? Or this one again, I don't mind. Ooh, perhaps we could try the blue drawing room.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.